We considered together how faith is not just believing, but putting belief into action. Today, we consider how putting faith into action is not a solitary, lonely, individual action. The scripture starts out with three examples of faith. The first is the contrast between the children of Israel and the Egyptians crossing the Red Sea. As you recall, Pharaoh had finally, after 10 plagues, said the children of Israel could leave Egypt. Moses led them to the Red Sea, off in the distance. They could see Pharaoh's chariots in hot pursuit. The Israelites said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness?" God told Moses to stretch his staff out over the Red Sea, and the water parted, and dry land appeared. The children of Israel set out across the Red Sea with walls of water on either side of them. Even though they thought they were going to be killed by the Egyptian army, God parted the waters and saved them. The Egyptian army tried to chase them into the sea, but their chariot wheels became clogged. And then they were drowned when the sea returned to its normal depth. Notice that both groups thought they could cross the Red Sea on dry land provided by God. The Israelites were doubtful that God was going to save them. But when he provided a way, they took it. The Egyptians saw the opportunity and tried to take it, but they were not in accordance with God's will. The faith that saved the Israelites was a gift from God, in accordance with the will of God, not any great action on the part of the Israelites. The next example of faith is Jericho. Now, as you recall, the children of Israel came upon the promised land, and it was full of people and great cities. The 12 spies sent out by Moses, one from each of the 12 tribes of Israel, were all afraid, except Caleb and Joshua. The 10 who were afraid reported that the people who live in the land are strong, and the towns are fortified and very large. The Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron and said, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt." As a result, God caused them to wander an additional 40 years in the wilderness. God told Moses, "None of the people who have seen the glory and the signs that I did in Egypt and in the wilderness shall see the land that I swore to give to their ancestors." After the additional 40 years of wandering, the Israelites entered the promised land and came upon one of those fortified cities the spies had seen, a city called Jericho. The faith shown by those people were following the instructions of God, who then gave them the city. The faith of Rahab the prostitute was shown by protecting the messengers of God who hid in her house. Interestingly, she is listed in the lineage of Jesus in Matthew. Rahab, who was not even a Jew, is listed in Hebrews as an example of faith and the favor of God. We should draw the conclusion from these first three examples that faith is not about me. In each of these cases, God acted first. God led the children of Israel to the Red Sea and provided a way, All they had to do was trust and obey. God led the children of Israel to the walls of Jericho and gave them a most unconventional way of conquest, one that none of them could claim as being the result of their own strength. The walls of Jericho fell by God's action. God sent the spies to Rahab, and she responded by protecting them. Proceeding beyond these first three examples, we see a list of judges of Israel. We do not have time today to tell each of their stories, but suffice it to say, they do not prevail by their own ability. Perhaps the best example of this is when God causes Gideon to reduce the size of his army, even though he is already terribly outnumbered. When Gideon's army prevails, it is undeniable that the result is from God, not by Gideon's or any man's greatness. Gideon showed faith by relying on God when God's instructions seemed to go against military wisdom. The stories throughout the Bible lead us to this same conclusion. The Presbyterian Church has a Sunday school series that was written many years ago called the Covenant Life Curriculum, or CLC. One of the most memorable books in that series is called The Mighty Acts of God. That book traces throughout the Bible stories like these that highlight how God has acted through people in the Bible. The point is not the greatness of Gideon, or Samson, or even King David. The point is that God acts mightily through humans who trust God. Furthermore, these acts of faith are not solitary actions. Looking at the scripture, we see the writer of Hebrews comparing faith to a race with a great cloud of witnesses. The race of faith is also a race that has already been run and won by Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. I love this analogy. For many years, I was a serious runner. Pretty much every day, I joined my friends for a run. We pushed each other and made each other better. If someone felt bad, at least one member of the group lagged back and encouraged the straggler. We shared stories of our aches and pains and what we did about them. Some said the best way to solve a pain such as shin splints was to run through it. Some said the best way to solve the pain was to rest. Others said the pain was a sign that it was time to buy new shoes. The point is, the collective wisdom of the group helped everybody. On race day, everyone had their own pace and their own strategy. We would talk over pacing and ways to adjust for each unique course. But on race day, the training partners were largely on their own. Unless someone decided their goal was to support a friend in achieving their PR, that is, personal record. However, in the best races, you're never alone. I ran 14 marathons, and my favorites were always the ones that had the best crowd support. The Dallas White Rock Marathon prided itself on its water station competition. Each water station spread out along the course about every 2.5 miles and would try to be better than the others. They would dress in costumes. They would play music. They would cut up fruit and candy bars for quick nutrition. They would serve Gatorade as well as water. And then there was the Coors station where they would serve cold beer at mile 20. The Marine Corps Marathon in Washington, D.C., ran up and down the National Mall and had water stations manned by Marines who yelled encouragement while other Marines ran in formation along with the runners. The New York Marathon ran through all seven boroughs and had people lining the route from many different nationalities and cultures. I particularly remember the Orthodox Jews in their black hats and curls on either side of the brow. But my favorite was the Boston Marathon, which began in Hopkinton, Massachusetts, and ran point to point to Boston. We ran through many small towns, 17 to my recollection. Each had its own high school band, high school cheerleaders, firemen, and local citizens aligning the route, shouting encouragement. The amazing thing to me was that many of us were also RANs, the ones who came in minutes or even hours behind the winners. Yet the crowd stuck around and encouraged all of us. It helped that the race was always run on Patriots Day, which is a state holiday, and everyone is in a festive mood. Most runners hit the wall at some point relatively late in the race. The average is said to be around mile 20. For me, it was usually mile 18. When you hit the wall, it's like your body is running out of fuel. I can best describe it with an automobile example. If you've ever had your alternator go out in your car and you're running just on the battery, the spark plugs can only go so long on the battery, and then they slow down and you go slower and slower and slower until the battery can no longer fire the plugs at all. After hitting the wall, my legs would feel heavier and heavier, and I would lose pace. It was in the final miles of the race, after hitting the wall, that the crowd's encouragement became so much more important. Without the crowd, it was easy to start thinking, why am I doing this? Why